SQL Down Under is a podcast for professionals working in the SQL Server community. SQL Server is a trademark of Microsoft Corporation. Opinions expressed during the podcast are individual opinions and may not reflect the opinions of SQL Down Under or of Microsoft Corporation. Introducing Show 84 with guest Rob Sewell. Our guest today is Rob Sewell. Rob's a SQL Server DBA and a data automation and PowerShell engineer. He's both a Microsoft Data Platform and Azure MVP. So welcome, Rob.
Welcome. That's a mouthful, isn't it?
Indeed. All good. So what I get everyone to do when they're first on the show is just tell us a little bit about who you are, where you're from, and how you come to be doing what you're doing.
So, my name's Rob, like you said, and I live in the UK. And what I do these days is help organizations and teams to automate the deployment of their infrastructure for data platforms. So that's that's a roundabout way of saying we do a lot of Terraform, a lot of Bicep, and we deploy Databricks, Azure Data Factory, Azure SQL, those sort of things. How did I get here? Yeah, that's a long story. But once upon a time, I was a lowly a service desk person, and somebody said, would you like to be a DBA? And then I ended up as a DBA. All of my team left, so I ended up having to survive by my own wits, and which makes you learn a lot, but nearly burnt me out. And then I found the SQL community and joined a user group and started speaking and found that I loved it. And then moving on from that, I ended up working with different people, different organizations, and I got to where I am now, and it's fantastic.
Totally awesome. Well, listen, what we talked about discussing today is I've not had a show at any stage where we talked about the command line tools for SQL Server, and we've had some changes in that area lately, so I thought we'd kick off there. And so I suppose the original old one, I mean, apart from people like me that are old enough to remember really old tools like SQL Admin Facility and things like that, but OSQL was the first one that most people came across.
Yeah, I mean, OSQL, OSQL, everybody sort of is forgotten in the mists of time. And really, what does the O stand for? Because there was also iSQL at the same sort of time, which was interactive. So, you know, jokingly, I say these days that OSQL stands for old SQL, and it's, you know, what Gianluca Sartori and Grant Fritchie used to use when they first started talking to SQL instances. But really, it was quite a basic CLI querying tool that just enabled you to open a connection, and that was pretty much about it. There was no parameters. You couldn't pass a file in, couldn't use like a DAC or anything like that. So it all changed.
The thing that people love though is it was always there. So so when you installed the server, it was already always there. But the tip is that might not be the case in future.
Yeah, that's the point, I think, is that because the next thing that came was SQL CMD. Which came with SQL 2005. Well, Hugo did correct me to make sure I was absolutely specific with this, is it actually came with the second or third CU of SQL 2005.
Yes.
Now, that is the one I think that the majority of people are well used to. And certainly our, you know, when I was starting as a DBA and in that team, we always very much made sure that you knew how to use SQL CMD, because like you said, it might be the only thing that you had.
Yeah.
You know, if your instance went you know, got overloaded, and the only thing you could do was connect with a DAC connection, and you could only get onto the instance, onto the host. Mm. You had no management studio. All you had was SQL CMD. Then you had to be able to get in and run it.
Indeed. And it's actually something. It's funny you mentioned iSQL. The thing came to mind when you said that. Of course, is that people also forget that way back then the query analyzer tool was a completely separate tool to the enterprise manager tool, which eventually together morphed into Management Studio. But Management Studio also got the SQL CMD mode that we could run queries in as well.
That's right, yes. So you also... I think it's a massively underused thing, apart
totally
from
agree.
when you're doing deployments, it seems. It sits there, and it just enables you to go straight into that mode of being able to mainly just set your variables within your query to be able to run just using that very lightweight CLI tool.
Mm. Yeah, in fact, the funny thing with the SQL CMD mode, the one thing I was most excited about when that first appeared was the colon connect business, where I could then connect off to a different server and then do some work and then connect to another one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there was no way to do that in a script prior to that.
No, that was the first thing I did was a database mirroring solution upgrade, an update script that we had. And that used to do that, just to flip between the instances and run the script to do whatever it was it needed to do at the time. And it was like, great, this, you don't have to have instructions that say, and now go and connect to the mirror. That's no longer going to be the mirror, because it's going to be the one we fail over to. You know, used to get confused about which, you know, what do we call this? It is primary, but it's going to be secondary. So we used to have all that fun in descriptions in documentation.
Mm. Actually, the thing that I was most excited about, as I said, was the connect option. But it was also the first thing that I fell foul of. and it was because I hadn't realized that changing to a different server wouldn't be a batch separator. And so I had a script that said connect to one server, then I had a bunch of commands, and I said connect to the next server, do a bunch of commands, connect to the next server, do a bunch of commands. And of course, it ran all of the commands against the last server, which to me is just bizarre and unexpected behavior.
You're like, no, don't do that. That's not what I want you to do.
And for the life of me, I still think that was like a fundamental design mistake. I mean, you know, the minute you change to a different server, that should be the end of the batch.
you would imagine so. You would imagine so. And of course, the other thing you had at that time was the PowerShell mini shell, which was it wasn't the first place I got involved with PowerShell, but it's the first place I used it with work particularly.
Yeah.
And that was sort of PowerShell V1 and V2's method of giving you the ability to connect to different types of technology, which you had this mini shell that's kind of used the main XE, but it had a load of different stuff. And I very quickly changed and realized that there was a better way of doing that, and everything came into the main PowerShell, and now we've kind of split out again, and we're going back to a better sort of package management version with PowerShell 7, which is probably what they should have done for those early ones. But
so
that was
with SQL CMD, apart from replacing some variables, was there and connecting to different servers, was there anything else that you found compelling about SQL CMD as opposed to just the normal DAC connections?
DAC connection.
Mm-hmm.
That was the big thing that saved me, you know, a dozen times. Need to be able to connect to this instance. There it is.
Yeah. And also I thought initially when they did it too, it was an OLADB connection as opposed to OSQL or OSQL.
ODBC.
It's funny, I never say the word SQL. I always say SQL. But with OSQL, I tend to always say OSQL. It's a strange thing. But anyway, the but yeah, that was an ODBC-based tool. And then we had SQL CMD initially was sort of OLADB, but I notice in all the doco in recent years, they talk about it being an ODBC-based tool as well.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that Hugo said when I first did this session about it, was that that was the thing that enabled the release, was the ODBC connections coming through.
Yeah. I think it was was it 2012, I think it was, where they decided that ODBC was going to be the first class citizen, and mostly because they could have JDBC parity on a lot of these things and so on as well.
Yeah. And I think that's where it really exploded in use as something useful.
So tell us what's been happening lately, because this has been a relatively quiet area for quite a while, and so really a decade, and now things are moving again.
Yeah, so I think the things that happened is in two places, because number one is that we you know, everything should be cross-platform. PowerShell's cross-platform, Azure Data Studio is cross-platform, SQL Server runs cross-platform, and we're much more open to the fact that our teams can work using Windows, using Unix, using Mac, and it doesn't matter. And SQL CMD doesn't work for that. So that's one side of it. And the other side of it is that in our development environments, what we want to do is enable our developers to be able to spin things up nice and quickly and easily.
Yeah.
So that they can do some work and then throw it away, and then do some work and throw it away, and keep all of our code in source control and all of those good development practices. But actually making sure that you've got Docker or Podman or Systemd installed in the right way with the right network bridges and having the volumes mounted to the right storage is something that some people really enjoy doing, and some people are just like, this is too confusing and it doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
So having an easy way of just going, can I have a new SQL instance as a container running my database, was another option. Yeah. So those two things enabled Microsoft to think about developing a new CLI tool. And they chose to take over, or fork, I guess is a better way. They chose to fork the MS SQL DB Go CLI tool. And they're they're calling it SQL CMD. But to avoid confusion, they're referring it to it as Go SQL CMD, because it's written in the language.
Yeah, it's so strange, isn't it? Because it's kind of like there's Go-SQL all over the place, and then people talk about Go SQL CMD, but then the command ends up being SQL CMD. So it's that's a little tricky in terms of that naming.
I think we know that Microsoft have history with naming things.
Yes.
So the beauty of Go SQL CMD is it's open source. You can see it all on GitHub. You can
cross platform. You said
write it. Yep, it's cross platform, so it works on all of the operating systems, but also all of the architectures as well. Because we have to be able to work with different versions of silicon that's inside the boxes as well.
Yeah. It's sort of interesting, isn't it? Because I notice NVIDIA and others now manufacturing new ARM processors and things, and so on, targeted at Windows. And that whole everything was Intel thing seems to be changing pretty rapidly.
Yeah. My wife has just got a new Apple laptop, and that's got its own silicon inside it, which is different again. So it's something that we need to be able to interact with. So that's one side of it, and then the other side of it is that to take care of this whole containerization and creation and development piece, is that as long as you've got a container virtualization software, so you've got Docker or you've got Podman or you've got Systemd on your machine, then you can just go SQL CMD, create MS SQL, and it will create you a container with the latest image of SQL Server on it. It will rotate your SA password. It will disable the SA account. It will create you a new account with a password and store it in a context so that you can just straight have a connection.
Grab it and save it, yeah.
So. Yeah. So you don't need to do SQL CMD-USA- carry on. You can just do SQL CMD query and it goes, I know currently we're connected to this particular container with this account and password that you don't even need to know about. And you can just run your query.
What about agreeing to the license agreement? Because that was always a thing with command line installs.
Yeah. So the, you can do a --, accept EULA. Or you can set an environmental variable. So you still have to do that, but it's very simple and it tells you very quickly. The best thing, honestly, I think the best thing about this new Go SQL CMD is the amount of help and assistance it gives you. Not just when you do a --, help, but actually when you run that. So if you run SQL CMD create MS SQL, you know, you accept EULA or whatever, it will then do its stuff. And then afterwards it'll say, hey, I've done this. Now, if you would like to query your instance, you can do this. If you would like to open Azure Data Studio, you can do this. If you would like to get rid of it, you could like to do this. This is the context that you're in. And it's like all of this help rather than like, okay, the command's finished. And you're like, what's next? You know, if you try and do that and you haven't got Docker installed, it'll come up and it'll say, hey, you know, I can't do this, but you could choose to go here and get Docker or choose to go here and get Podman and then come back and we'll be able to do it. So it's much more helpful, much more interactive. It's super good.
And output formatting?
So... We've all played the game if we've worked with CLI tools where you get a text of columns returned and you end up with dashes all over the place and everything out of sync. Yeah. So with SQL CMD you can flip it so that you can have the columns and the rows displayed vertically. It's great if you're a DBA and you're just looking at getting one row of data back about your AG connections or something like that, then it's going to work really well. If you're a developer and you're just doing a couple of rows, it's probably going to work. If you're getting 100,000 rows, it's not going to look so good.
And look, it's if you're doing that, it's probably the wrong tool unless it's going into a file, perhaps.
Absolutely. So that's one way that you can format your data. But then there's another way as well. If you think about the most requested connect item for Management Studio was, we would like to have dark mode, please, because people are annoying. But in Azure Data Studio, in Visual Studio Code, in all of these new modern tools, we're used to being able to change the theme of our what we're interacting with to make it easier for our eyes, or you know, if we've got color blindness or whatever, we can change that. And in SQL CMD you can do the same thing, so you can actually do, you're back to your colons, but you're not doing a connect to something else this time. You're doing a set SQL CMD color scheme is the name of the title, but that enables you to then change the color scheme of the result set that you get. And in a demo, when you're showing it off, it's like, oh, look at this, you can do this. And then people go, yeah, great, why? And I go, well, what about all of your team that's got color blindness? Where being able to look at yellow on black or pink on green or whatever it is that works for them makes it easier for them to work, means they don't get so tired, means they make less mistakes, don't have to concentrate so hard. These are the reasons that you would do that and enable them to do that. So I think it's a real.
I always thought it was one of the big things in integration services prior to 2012 is that all the precedence constraints were red, yellow, red, blue, and green. And of course, the majority of people with colorblindness, red and green were the biggest issue for them. And but at least in 2012, they gave you the option to add labels beside the constraints so that at least you could tell this was a success constraint. But it really struck me as odd that there wasn't ever a way to just simply change the colors, you know, to something that suited the user. It did seem odd. With Management Studio, though, too, because, of course, it was based on Visual Studio, the shell. I mean, the dark mode stuff was underneath there. Actually, I have a Management Studio Tips and Tricks book, and in that I did show how to set dark mode in there, but the problem is it wasn't that. It's that so many of the dialogues were not designed with that in mind, and so even if you did manage to set it, it really wasn't a thing that was thought through. It isn't just a case of enabling it. You know, they really have to design all the dialogues so they work in dark mode.
The Management Studio is a big spaghetti mess of code and add-ons and things all sat on top of that Visual Studio. So it was never something that was going to be easy to implement.
No, and yet it's still by far the most favourite tool. You know, and I think it's just simply mostly because the people that use it the most are admins, and it's the thing that still has all the admin functionality. Yeah, by comparison with any other tool.
And I think we're used to it always being there.
Well, since 2005.
Yeah, 2005. Yeah.
So some of us have seen earlier versions of tools.
But, I mean, to be fair, that's like two decades, Greg. You know, we're
yes,
old.
Yes,
we're old and grey.
Indeed it is. And so, listen, so anything else that you particularly like about the new SQL CMD?
You can absolutely run it alongside existing SQL CMD. If you needed, for some reason, something wasn't working, you could absolutely have it alongside. You can mm-hmm. use the new and the old versions together. So there's no incompatibility versions there, other than making sure that your path works for the. For the command itself, and being able to just take your existing code and pretty much run it. So if you're going to use it, if you're using SQL CMD in a deployment pipeline or some sort of automation tooling, you can probably just make use of this new version as well.
Yeah. Installation. Cool. And I suppose we should sort of mention so. With Windows, you've got, I think from memory, both Winget and, I mean, there's a Chocolaty install as well.
Yeah. It's really simple. You use your package manager, you know, like Winget, mm-hmm. Choco, Yum, APT, and Brew, and then you type install SQL CMD or upgrade SQL CMD. And for pretty much all of those, it's just going to work. It's just going to go and do... Do what
and so Mac OS and Linux just brew, and that brings that in. Yep.
Yeah. And it just does the install, and then the everything is exactly the same. There is literally no difference between them. But then the other question then is, can we connect to Azure?
Hmm.
Okay, so when you think about, that's cool. I want to be able to connect to Azure as well. How do we do that? However you want to. So you can literally just do, if you're already signed into your machine with AZ CLI, then you can just do a SQL CMD dash G, and it will just take that session token and make use of it to connect to your Azure database.
Yeah.
Or you can use the authentication method parameter, and you can choose any of the types of Azure authentication, so service principal, management entity, username, password, all of those are also available to you.
Hi, this is Greg. Just wanted to thank you for listening to this show.
and let you know that if you'd like to let me teach you more about SQL Server, we now have both free courses and low-cost courses available online and on demand. The courses include detailed hands-on lab work for you to complete to reinforce your learning, and there are more courses coming in the next few months. You'll find details at training.sqldownunder.com.
So if you are running a virtual machine in Azure, are you able to get it to use a user-assigned managed identity that's associated with the virtual machine? Do you know?
I'm going to say absolutely yes for certain. I'm going to say there is a managed identity. There is a managed identity flag for that authentication parameter. So you can definitely pass in the managed identity and say this is what I want to use. Yeah. So it's a good thing. Something we should check actually. I'm going to have a play.
Yeah.
And then
listen, continue.
I was going to say the other beautiful thing when you think about Azure is if we have created ourselves a container, that's all very well and good. We've got a native Azure SQL, the SQL Server container there. You could say to it, "I'd like a database," and it will create your blank database. But most of the time, our databases have got schemas and views and stored procedures and all of the rest of it, and maybe some data in there as well. So you could then deploy, you know, or run a script to add your schema or data. But you know, actually, what we want to do is be able to restore a backup. Yeah. And you can just say to it, "I would like you to restore a backup," and you say using, that's the parameter that they've chosen, and pass in the path to an HTTP or HTTPS endpoint that's got a .back file on it. Now, as we know, everybody has their SQL Server backups stored on HTTPS endpoints with .back extension. That's the joke for anybody that's not realizing that.
We have sort of been able to do that since 2012.
Yeah. But far better if we could actually use it from Azure storage and use a SAS token. So we can pass in a SAS token URL to a backup file, and then we can back up from Azure. Now, there's a limit there, because when you understand what it's doing, it is taking that backup and bringing it down to a new mount that it's created, which will be /opt/var/msql/backup is what it's created. So it pulls the file into there, and then it will restore the backup. So you need to have that space available, and you might find you can't do the Stack Overflow database onto there, because your Docker will just goes, "I can't cope with all of this storage." And it will take the amount of time it takes to download that file all the way across and then do the restore. So it's a double storage impact, if you like, on your container. And then the other cool, like the really cool nerdy thing is, if you're not happy with just making use of all this cool stuff that you've got, and you're like, "I wonder what's coming next," or "I want to play," you can take the PR codes or the branch codes that's in GitHub. You can run them through. I used a Go dev container.
Yep.
And then you can compile the SQL CMD exe, and you can start making use of that. And then you can see the things that are coming, and some of the things that are coming are really cool. So the being able to restore, you know, we can restore a backup from Azure storage, but actually I'd like to be able to restore a backup from my own machine, because, you know, we can give our developers the access to the backup, and makes it much much simpler. Being able to do that, pull it through, is good. And that's available, you know, there's nothing secret about this. This is available for you to find on GitHub and go through and do yourself. And being able to do some of these things once you have your container already up and running in your thing, being able to add something else into it, so add a backup or add a new database or whatever. Being able to do that straight from the command line as well is really neat. So it's always moving forward. I think we're 1.4 now is the latest release at the moment. So in a matter of a few months, it's got forward and got better. So it's a really neat tool. I really love it. It's a lot of fun.
It looked like. There seems to be a lot of interest in the tool, and it potentially could end up with a lot of contributors. So that'll be sort of interesting as that sort of continues on over time. It's excellent. Actually, one thing when you were talking about restoring a backup, in fact, that would be yet another place where a managed identity would be kind of interesting, of course, is to be able to go off and access the storage account using that. Have you found anything that's not compatible, I suppose? One of the challenges when, as soon as you do something cross-platform, is that, I don't know, you start to have potential issues with, I don't know, backslashes or things, or, you know, just various characters and things that can be problematic. But has it been pretty clean for what you use?
It's been totally clean for all the things that I've done. It's connected to to all of the databases, all the instances, all the versions, and pretty much everything we've done has worked. But I guess I haven't actually done the cross-platform path scenario where, you know, maybe I'm running on a runner on a Ubuntu OS in Azure DevOps, and I'm connecting to a Windows hosted SQL instance. I haven't done that and needed to pass path through. But if that comes through, then I would imagine you'd see it in the issues. And it hasn't come across my field of vision when I'm looking at that stuff. Mm. So
I did run into one or two things, but I mean it was sort of silly things, you know, like commas in a file name and so on, like things like that, which eventually could get around. You can sort of like triple quote the thing and so on, but you know the thing is like who puts that there in the first place? But yeah, I always think when you do that sort of thing, like even if you can get away with it, you're like, I mean, there's enough things out there in the world that'll bite you without going looking for things to bite you.
Yeah.
And yeah, that sort of thing is just guaranteed to cause that sort of problem.
It's that thing, isn't it? It's just because you can doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do.
Hey, listen, you also, of course, mentioned Ubuntu and so on. What's your feeling on the traction so far for Linux versions of SQL Server?
I think the fact that it's interesting. I think most people who are in the world where they're perfectly happy to spin up a container and connect to it realize that the SQL is SQL when it comes to it. Well, you know, the performance on the different operating systems is the same. The execution is identical. You know, the code that you're running, like literally at the base level, your base SQL Server code is absolutely
the same. It is the same code.
People totally understand that, and I think that message is through. There's no doubting of that. Those sort of people are just totally happy because we, you know, you know that you can develop, you know, I could write my SQL scripts on a Ubuntu machine running a container and send it to you who's using an Apple machine, say, and you could run some things and you can test it, and then we could pass it on to somebody else who's using Windows, and it's all going to behave exactly the same, and we're completely happy with that. I think when it comes to running production workloads on it, people are a little bit more reticent, and the DBA heart in me understands why, because you know We're extraordinarily cautious because we're looking after people's data, and you know we want to make sure that nothing's going to happen.
I think also it depends on where they come from, right? Yeah. So I mean, if you've got an ex Oracle on Unix shop or something, I mean they're going to be very, very comfortable with that as an option. And in fact, I'm presuming that's one of the key reasons it exists in the first place.
Yeah, it is literally the firms who don't want to have Windows but do want to have SQL Server. So you know, why not? But I think also if you look at this, some of these ideas I've been talking about for using SQL CMD with the development, spinning up containers, those sort of things, and the fairly new AZD executable experience where you can create an environment and spin up a whole bunch of things. The idea, I think, is that you're going to get to a point where you can develop, you know, I could develop a tool in two containers running, you know, Go or React or Rust or something, and SQL in two little containers. And that code, if it becomes amazing and 10 million people want to use it, you can spin it up in Azure and you can expand it, and it will run in Azure SQL and it will run in, you know, in Azure stack web apps or function apps or whatever you're using. And it's going to carry on working exactly the same. And then you can scale it all the way up and you go, right, crikey, actually, we're going to go on to 10 for whatever reason. That database is still going to work. So I think once you can see that is the idea that people, you know, that you could take that from tiny idea, proof of concept, to production and still have it all working, then actually it becomes so much easier when you take the operating system out of the thing altogether. And containers work much better with Unix.
Yes, I would not disagree with you there. I mean, anybody who's ever run containers much on a Windows laptop or something, you sort of realise it's not the same experience. So.
Yeah.
Although it's not bad. It's not bad. But, it's certainly not the same.
I think trying to run Windows containers, I mean, I used to use Andrew Prusky's Windows container images for a load of testing of stuff in ages ago, and there, you know, you're looking at things that are like 3 gigabytes in size for an image instead of, you know, a few hundred meg, and they take much longer to work, and their performance is not as good. You know, all of this stuff within your container is just not so good. Whereas I can do a 50-minute presentation about SQL CMD and create 20 new instances in that time and query them and throw them away. You know, that's the beauty.
Yeah, being able to spin things up and dispose of them is just such a crucial requirement, particularly in DevOps style environments and things like that. So, as we spend a lot of our time discussing, so
and I think there's another place where SQL CMD is fantastic. If you've created yourself a container and you've created a new database and you've done your coding, you've put, you know, some data in and you run some tests against a, you know, different application or whatever to make sure it's doing what you want, and then you go, oh yeah, I'm just going to throw it away. What SQL CMD will do is go, yeah, sure, throw it away. And then it goes, hang on a minute, you've got a user created MDF on that. Are you sure you want me to throw it away? Because if I throw it away, it's gone.
It's gone,
So like it actually comes back and goes, this is what I found. Yeah, is that okay? And then you go, oh yeah, no, actually yes it is. Or I need to make sure I've backed that up, or I've got the code or whatever, and look through. So
listen, it's getting close to time, Rob, but the where will people see you with things coming up?
Oh, so well,
he said thinking about SQL Bits in particular. So
we've had so much fun talking about SQL CMD. Yeah, so one of the other things I do in my spare time, not sure I have any spare time, is I'm a committee member for SQL Bits. SQL Bits is the largest data platform conference Jeremy Clarkson would say, in the world. But
I would say the coolest as well, right? Or
Without doubt, one of the things we certainly make sure we do very well is have a good theme. And I am in the middle of the content selection process right now. So mm-hmm. we will have one day of training days. So we'll have something between 10 and 14 training days. And we will have one day of 100-minute sessions. So these are new sessions or new mm-hmm. session length for us. To enable one of three things, either a deep dive into something, you know, very technical, a generic overview, because you can't fit an overview of something mm-hmm. into 50 minutes very easily, but also the ability to sort of chain things together. So maybe you want to do a mm-hmm. morning about something, you'll be able to do sort of follow along those sort of things.
Yeah.
And then we'll have 3 days of 50-minute and 20-minute sessions from mm-hmm. MVPs and Microsoft teams and all of the people that you'd expect.
Clever people. Yeah, yeah. All over the place.
All the people to that.
In fact, I love it's the one conference that I've just been kicking myself for years that I haven't managed to get to. And I will, you know. But I would have already been had it not been for COVID and so on. Yeah. But the one that still sticks in mind with seeing all the photos from when they had the steampunk themed edition of the conference, that just looked unbelievable. And the reason that came to mind is I've actually been doing some user group talks in southern part of New Zealand the last couple of weeks, and I did spend a couple of days in Oamaru, which has Steampunk HQ, which is a massive museum and things. And the whole time, I just couldn't stop thinking about the SQL Bits pictures.
That was the first year we really went to town with the theme and the for the party particularly. And I still remember the gasp as people had come into a big room and it had a bar and it had a dance, and they were like, "Oh, right, so that's what's going to be." And there was a great big curtain, and nobody really knew what was the other side.
Yeah.
And then the curtain, it didn't drop. I think it opened, and the other side was this whole steampunk funfair environment with actors all dressed up. It was just amazing. There was just this gasp as people were like, "Oh, what is this?" So
that's so cool.
And
that's good.
I think it
enables, I was going to say thanks for that. So what date is that happening?
So it's happening on March the 19th to the 23rd mm-hmm. of 2024, so next year. And it's at a place called Farnborough. And Farnborough,
which is where the air shows are.
There we go.
Indeed.
It's well known for being where the air shows are, and that means that the theme is flight.
Wonderful.
So that will be the basis for it. And Farnborough, for those that don't know, is an hour and a bit outside of London, on a train line on a main highway route for people to be able to get to as well.
Yeah, easy to get to. Yeah, that's good. Hey, listen, so. Thank you so very much for sharing your knowledge today, Rob.
Thank you for having me. It's been joyful.
Awesome. Thank you.